Welcome to Urbanism Vancouver, a podcast that explores how our built environment shapes our everyday lives and community experiences. I'm your host, Helen Loy. Join me as we discover where we live, work, and play, and how we can shape better communities. With each episode, we'll bring a bit of insight and industry experience from myself and my guests. We'll dive into the inner workings of our urban surroundings and explore how places are planned, designed, and built, and discuss ways to create more livable, equitable, and sustainable cities. I hope that you'll learn a little and be inspired to be more curious and more involved in impacting positive change. Before we get started today, we want to acknowledge that this podcast is recorded and produced on the traditional and unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples, including the Musqueam, Squamish, and the Tsleil-Waututh Nations. We pay our respects to their elders past, present, and emerging, and recognize the enduring connection they have to this land. We strive to have our conversations contribute towards reconciliation and work towards sustainability and equity for all the custodians of the lands. One of our greatest challenges in city building is the movement of people. And in North America, the biggest hurdle seems to stem from a lack of a robust public transit system. What's holding us back from having rapid and reliable transit? And can we learn from our international counterparts? Joining us today on this topic is Rhys Martin, or also more widely known on YouTube as the creator and host of RM Transit.
So I grew up in Surrey and Langley in Metro Vancouver. I lived the first 20 years of my life there, and I had almost no transit for a lot of it. The only transit I had was the community shuttle that was 30 minutes away from my house walking, and that would take me to Langley Center. And then from there, I could take another bus that would take me to Surrey, and then I could get on the SkyTrain. So I didn't have great transit most of the time growing up in Vancouver, but I did grow up there, and I really appreciate the system that does exist when you get out of the deep suburbs. Loved the SkyTrain and grew up sitting at the front like many Vancouver children do. Always thought it was very interesting. So when I went into university, I decided to move to Toronto because it was kind of, you know, the biggest city for transit in Canada. A lot of transit was being built in Toronto at the time and a lot still is. And so I live in Toronto most of the time. I travel around quite a bit. I've spent a lot of time in New York and in Montreal over the years. And so I've got to, you know, kind of appreciate those cities as well, but also just kind of traveling all around the world to different cities and seeing what they do well, what they don't do so well in their transit systems, and often bringing that back to Canada and comparing it to Vancouver, Toronto, and talking about how we could be better.
What got you into making content?
I started my YouTube when I was in university, and when I was starting it, I just wanted there to be like videos of Toronto on the internet because there were so few HD videos of the Toronto subway system and the streetcars on YouTube back in like 2016 and 15, surprisingly. There was like nothing, and now there's tons of stuff. But I just wanted to put videos online, and I did some when I was back in Vancouver, just posted stuff. And at some point, I guess I decided that, yeah, like I was annoyed at some things I kept hearing, or I wanted to share my opinion on things, and I thought like, oh, I'll just sit in front of the camera and talk. And from there, I just kept doing that for a really long time. And now I'm here. I run my YouTube channel full time, and it's a lot of fun.
I also grew up in the Fraser Valley, and I think we kind of take for granted, people who grow up in Vancouver take for granted like how good our transit system is here. And when I went to Toronto, I think I was quite shocked at the train system, how long it took to get to downtown, the fact that there was no cell phone reception throughout most of it. I think I imagined that Toronto being a bigger city with a much bigger population, that it would just come with a much better transportation system. But obviously, it's also over a much larger geographic area.
Well, I think you've touched on a lot of interesting things here. So first thing is that there are all these discrepancies, right? the natural human way of thinking is that bigger is going to be better. And so like, yeah, like that's one of the first things you notice is that like bigger cities aren't always better. And Toronto is a good example of that. Like Vancouver within North America has pound for pound per capita, probably among the best systems. Like it's easily competitive with anything else, especially post-COVID where the, you know, the American systems have kind of collapsed and SkyTrain is still going strong. So yeah, Vancouver, really good. Internationally, places I like to point to are the very commonly pointed to places like Switzerland and Japan, Germany, France. Like these places are all very good at public transit and housing and other urban issues as well. But I also think that there are a lot of like kind of underappreciated countries that are really good. So like Sweden and Spain and Italy and Korea, for sure. It's actually kind of abnormal to be as bad at public transit as most places in North America are. Like it's for a wealthy country. Most wealthy countries are a lot better. I mean, even Mexico, like in Mexico City, the metro system is very competitive with like the New York City subway, but Mexico is a much poorer country. And so that it's competitive is kind of crazy. So yeah, I think internationally, it's kind of those classic places. I actually think Canada's systems are pretty good. I think what gets distracting is people often talk about North America. And then there's all of the American transit systems that you look to. They suck generally, even in big cities like in San Francisco or in Boston, like they're disaster zones right now. And my favorite comparison growing up was like, look at Vancouver compared to Seattle or Portland, which are richer cities with bigger populations, and the transit is undeniably much worse in those cities. And I think that's something that Vancouverites should try to appreciate.
You mentioned Vancouver being good, like per capita. Is that a typical reference of measurement that you would kind of use when you quantify whether a transit system is good or bad, is kind of like looking at the service provided per capita?
That's kind of like a simplification I would use in the case of like looking at Canada. I think it's pretty hard to compare systems across geographies, which I do a lot, just because, you know, there's different populations and different geographic situations. You know, if you have a lot of waterways and mountains, it's way harder to build a transit system that's effective. And so I think that those are things that factor into it. But I also think what makes Vancouver good is that it just gets a lot of little things pretty good. So like, as you mentioned, there's cell service in Vancouver, which is not uncommon around the world, but it's less common than you would think to have like universal cell phone service, or the fact that you can pay with your credit card. Like Vancouver was one of the first systems in North America that allowed you to do that. And North America is not always great at this stuff, but it's actually pretty good internationally. And so it's just kind of a reference point of how does a city compare on like a bunch of different metrics compared to other cities? And I think in Canada, Vancouver just does really well despite not being as big as Montreal or Toronto.
I asked Rhys what he thought were the key barriers to massively improving transit in North America, in addition to the major attitude differences toward transit when comparing Canada and the United States.
So I think there's two really interesting things to talk about here. One is that like there is such a different culture in different places. Where I grew up in Langley, there was no culture of really taking public transit, at least in the community I lived in. Everyone drove. And where I was growing up, like I got my driver's license when I was 16, because yeah, like it is freedom, right? If there's only one bus an hour and it's 30 minutes away, yeah, you're trapped unless you have a car. So I think that a lot of the time, you know, you can't really blame people for getting in a car. Like the systems don't come to them. But at the same time, Canada is actually a lot better than I think people realize, because, well, there are the Surreys and the Langleys of the world. Vancouver and Toronto and Montreal have huge numbers of people in them, and Mississauga and other big cities. And, you know, it's pretty normal to take transit in Canada. It's not always the case that people don't find it unusual. But if you go to America and talk to a bunch of people, I think it's typically the case that riding the bus is seen as unusual, especially the bus. Even people who support transit are like, the bus, like that's how poor people travel around. And in Canada, I would say that there's always been a different culture around that. Like it's just more normalized to take transit. And I think that really helps. That it's just not seen as socially unacceptable. Even if people are going to like a concert or something and they don't usually use transit, they might take the SkyTrain to go to a concert or a sports game. And I think that it's even that like marginal thing where people do get on it from time to time, even if it's like once every 6 months, that like kind of moves the needle. And so people are like, oh yeah, you know, like I get it. I could commute this way if my job was in the right place and I lived in the right place. And so I think that there is more of a cultural understanding. Like it's more likely that your politician used public transit at some point in their life compared to in the US.
Rhys points to an interesting opportunity that we have in Canada that perhaps our American counterparts don't, that it is seen as socially acceptable to take transit. We should capitalize on this sentiment. Rhys and I then discussed how we can better approach conversations regarding the perceived dichotomy between space for transit versus space for cars.
In terms of cars specifically, they're definitely an issue, but I think that people, they spend so much time thinking about cars, and I think they're a bigger issue for walking and cycling. But so often, I think it distracts because transit can be good even if cars are good, and you don't need both to be good, and it's not very efficient to have both be good. But like, you look at Tokyo or Seoul is in particular, like in Korea, there's so many roads in that city and highways, and they've tons of cars. But the transit is also really good. Buses everywhere and the huge subway network. It's good to advocate to kind of restrict car use and to reduce parking and stuff. But it shouldn't be seen as like a barrier to making transit good. Like transit should just compete with cars. And there's a lot of trips already in a place like Vancouver where like if you're on a SkyTrain line and the SkyTrain, you know, gets bigger every couple of years, it's generally faster to take the SkyTrain than to drive already. And so I think it's just kind of a question of how do we design a transit system that beats the car? And it doesn't always have to be faster because transit's like way less expensive and, you know, you don't have to insure it and put gas in it. But it's about like kind of making it just a more compelling option. And cars are, you know, they're always probably going to exist to some extent, like even in places, those places I mentioned, like Switzerland and Japan, they're often still one car per family average. You know, some people will have more. A lot of people won't have a car. But it's just like, how can the marginal use case of transit become just the average use case? And even if people do have a car, reduce the number of cars, just making transit more competitive, I think it's totally doable at the same time as we restrict auto use. And the thing that's nice is that like there's not really a culture war battle to be fought over making transit better. You can make a case to anyone, even someone who's driving, that it's good for them. And so I think that's kind of my thinking on that issue.
I feel like sometimes when we get into some of those public discussions where a specific project is on the table, like a rapid bus line along Hastings in Vancouver, or even making sure that there's a dedicated bus lane, it often does feel like the public discussion is a debate of we promote this thing, which is public transportation. It's like directly at odds with the cars that could be there in that specific lane. So it feels like there is a dichotomy of if we want better one thing, we have to sacrifice cars in this example. And usually I find that's where some of the opposition comes in. Like recently we had TransLink was suggesting a new rapid bus lane to go down like Hastings, which is one of our main arterials. Mm-hmm. And some of the business associations kind of came out and said, we don't want that because the bus lane would take away parking that people would be able to come to this area and be able to park and shop and whatnot. How do we go about having that conversation where people don't feel like it's a threat to this other option that they currently have?
This is a very common thing. Like a business association doesn't want a bike lane or a bus lane or any kind of change because change is generally scary. But when you actually look at the numbers for almost any situation like this, most of the parking isn't on street anyways. It's usually in parking lots that are off street or parkades or it's behind the buildings. And so you have that, like the actual amount of parking is higher than people expect. The amount that's getting removed is probably lower than people expect. And so it's just kind of trying to reason with people and like meeting them where they are and being like, oh, yeah, like I get it. It's visible like that you're not, you usually have people that pull up right in front of your business and now they can't. So I think you just have to be nice and reasonable, but also just say generally the data doesn't support the idea that having like two less parking spots at your store is going to have a huge impact. And it will have a huge positive impact if we get rid of them and like make the buses faster, because then they'll be more competitive with driving. And you can fit way more people on a bus than in a car lane. And so like your number of customers is going to go up long term. I think that like one of the great tools to look at is just like looking at other cities in Canada, for example. Where did they put a bus lane in, and did it like decimate business? Probably not, because if it did, it would be everywhere on the news, because the news doesn't generally like transit. So I think it's kind of just like saying, hey, like Broadway has like sections of bus lane. No one thinks Broadway is going to be wiped off the face of the earth. Like, they're getting a subway now, and there's tons of development and business going on that corridor. It's just like a force that just uplifts everything in your neighborhood. You know, it makes your business more likely to have customers, but it also increases the value of property around the corridor, which leads to more investments, more tax revenue for the city to like install nice benches and stuff. So I think that there just needs to be like a case made by advocates, the transit agency, the BIA is often like the, you know, various business organizations. And I think that generally things trend in the right direction. So it requires a lot of grinding away and, you know, making the same arguments for a long period of time. But when the change happens, like the benefit's immense, and then it gets easier to do the next bit, because it's like you can just point down the street and say, they have the bus lane, they're doing fine.
Rhys has summarized a list of positive impacts that result from improving public transit, many of which most are probably familiar with. He notes that opposition to public transportation improvements are often vocal minorities, and that when the upgrades are complete, the massive public benefits are not celebrated enough. One example is the Canada Line in Vancouver.
I'm obviously biased because I like transit, but I don't associate Cambie with like the all of the businesses that were like, you know, filed lawsuits, etc. And you know, even just over the long term, the impact of that is so small compared to all the housing we've built and all of the people's lives that are just so much better because they had the transit. And there's also the fact that the Canada Line, you know, connected Richmond and the airport to Vancouver. Vancouver is one of the only cities that has that quality of link to the airport. And like, when you think about that, I think something like 25% of people get to the YVR now via the Canada Line. And like the environmental impact that has, like how hard would that be to achieve with electric buses or with building EV charging stations, and how much money would have had to be spent and how much effort to achieve that this transit was able to achieve and will continue to achieve for literal decades into the future. Maybe lessons to be learned about not impacting business, but the Canada Line was also so cheap. It was built so fast. And frankly, I think what often happens in situations like this is in trying to fix the problem, you sort of make it worse. So like the Broadway subway is being built in a kind of a slower way. And so you kind of ask, is the impact actually less, or is it just sort of spread out over more time rather than being more kind of succinct and kind of more extreme, but for a shorter period? And so I think, you know, these are challenges, but they're things that we have to go through as cities. And once you build the transit, especially like a subway, it's there for 100+ years. So you have a lot of time to recoup the benefit. And like, people don't think in 100-year time spans. And so it's not natural to think this just has to pay off over the next century. People think in like terms of like next month. And it makes it really hard to kind of consider the pluses and minuses.
I'm curious on what your thoughts are as to how future-proofed our systems are, whether it's Vancouver or Toronto, or I guess like Canadian cities in general. Because if it's a valid concern that our Canada Line was just put in recently, and it's already kind of, what I've heard is that it's already reached capacity, or like it's already full and we don't have an ability to like add another section of train or whatnot. Why does that happen? Why are we not more future thinking? Like, when I think about some of the Asian cities that I've traveled to, they're planning, like you said, for the 100-year return of this investment. Like, are we doing that? And if not, like, why? What are the barriers?
So we are definitely not planning forward enough. We do have this kind of very myopic approach where it's like, oh, one project at a time, and we don't look at the greater picture. With regard to the Canada Line specifically, like, people always say it's at capacity, but I think it's just because like people in Vancouver haven't gotten out enough to other cities, because subways are always busy in the morning. Go to any city and it's always like, it's busy. You have to stand. Yeah, you're going to be like tightly packed in the morning. The actual capacity of it is, it's like lower than it should be, but it will be okay for probably 20 more years. I think when it comes to the sort of forward thinking issue, the way I like to look at it is the Canada Line is fine as long as we build another north-south subway in Vancouver in the future. And I actually think that's far more important than like the Canada Line having 20 car trains or whatever. It's that we have a plan and that we actually keep building.
I was really curious about this specific comment from Rhys. I asked him to expand further on this dilemma. Would it be better for us to fund what can be designed and built sooner with the understanding that it will field a certain amount of public resistance, but then move on to the next line? Or would it be better for us to focus on building a project that is greater in length and capacity, knowing that it would cause more public disruption, but to do it just once?
This is a good example. People forget the history of something like pretty quickly after it happens. So like with the Canada Line, TransLink at the time, the head of TransLink, or like the, I forget what the term is, but like the head of the mayor's council was a guy from Burnaby. I forget his name, but he was like very infamous in the transit forums of Vancouver in like the 2010s. He was like fighting tooth and nail to like not have the Canada Line built. Like it was so close to being killed. And so the reason it was, I'm pretty sure the reason it was so low capacity was because they were like, oh, it's never gonna have any ridership and like this route's gonna fail and all of that. And so it was only small as a result of like people being skeptical that it would ever be popular. And so I think that's an important factor. Like we should try to right size things. Like the Canada Lines definitely should have been built bigger. But I think the thing we have to remember is that like Vancouver, I don't know, my vision of Vancouver is that the goal is for it to be a city of like 10 million people someday, like it to be a big city, because like Vancouver's beautiful. And why shouldn't more people be able to live in a beautiful, safe city like Vancouver, right? And that's good for that is environmentally friendly. And that just makes the world better. Even if it doesn't become a 10 million person city, Vancouver's going to grow a lot. And that means we're going to have to build a lot more subway lines over time. And so I think it's a lot more important that the subway building machine is good than the actual subways themselves, at least initially. You've got to build and build and build to get good at building. You look at Shanghai, for example. They have a huge metro system and they had like their own Canada Line moments. Like they built certain lines that were totally undersized when they sort of under-predicted how popular their metro would be. And the solution was just to build more lines that would take some of the pressure off of those lines. And in doing that, they also got the public capacity. The transit agencies learned how to be more effective at building subways so that they could build even more to other places that they wanted to. And I mean, like, we're always going to have to be building new underground stuff in a dense city like Vancouver. I think it's actually just really important that we learn how to be better at doing that rather than getting any one project perfect. Because if it's only like every 5 years or every 10 years, you become Toronto, where nothing got built for 30 years and it's just like a disaster zone.
So going back to this question, how do we become more forward thinking? How do we make it so that our cities and our systems aren't always just planning for the next 4 or 5 years? Is it public funding that we need more of? Like what are some of those huge barriers that we have here?
There definitely needs to be more of a plan. Like TransLink has their kind of Transit 2050 plan, which is okay. But when you look at cities like Shanghai or Santiago in Chile or Paris even, they had master plans for their transit systems 30 years before they started building. They drew lines. They said, these are where our transit lines are going to be. And then they, for the most part, built those systems. You know, you change things over time, like, oh, there's a big new housing area over here. We're going to like make the subway go over there. But having a really good long-term plan is so valuable because it not only does it let you have that kind of pipeline of projects so that you can keep building and like get really effective at constructing transit, but it also lets you plan like, yeah, where do you put the housing? So you can kind of create a city where the density is kind of distributed in a reasonable way. It's not like in pockets in random places. It's kind of concentrated along the transit lines. And you can also do a lot of forward-thinking things. So like, for example, we know that there's going to be a SkyTrain to UBC at some point. UBC could be planning, like they are talking about it, but what they could do to kind of put that into action is they could start setting aside land where you can put stations and doing things like Britain, for example. And like, this is a very random example, but I love it. To build some future subways in London, they actually have these what called like safeguarding laws, which make it so that in like certain places, you can't build a super deep foundation or you can't build a building in a certain place where transit is meant to go in the future. And by doing that, you know, you make it a lot cheaper and a lot more cost effective, a lot faster to build in the future. And You actually do kind of see this in Vancouver a bit. I think like South Granville Station on the Broadway subway, the development had like pre-built part of the entrance or something. And so we do a bit of this, but we should do like way more of it.
Rhys has highlighted a few important considerations that I want to emphasize. Firstly, there needs to be efficient systems of building transit. Though we can debate whether a certain subway line was appropriately sized, the more important goal should be to focus on ensuring that there's an efficient process and sufficient capacity to continue on to the next project quickly. Secondly, is the importance of projecting far into the future and collaborating with the various related industries. You may have seen the Dream SkyTrain maps of Vancouver, and there's a real benefit to shooting for the stars, because efficient transit infrastructure isn't just about getting lines built, it is also about ensuring that it is projected in proximity to jobs, amenities, and housing, which are all things that need to be in city plans and regional policies. But all of this relies on sufficient funding. And so I asked Rhys about the various ways in which transit systems across the world are funded.
There's all kinds of different models. In Paris, for example, they have basically this like a payroll tax effectively where almost every employer has to buy transit passes for their workers. And I believe it's at like a pretty high cost actually. And so they effectively fund the transit system. So that's one way. In London, they just have really high fares because London is expensive. And I guess they think that's acceptable. And so like, it's really expensive to ride in London. In Hong Kong, they famously do a ton of transit-oriented development, like MTR, the transit agency that runs the subway system in Hong Kong, builds the developments. And when they do that, they can do things like, hey, like we're building a parking garage for our development. Like the subway is integrated into that and it's all like a single team of engineers and planners. And that makes it way more efficient than having to go to various consultants and all of these engineering firms to do that kind of work. They're also very efficient at operating. So in Hong Kong, they actually make money on the operation alone, like just running the system. The fares pay out more money than it actually costs to run. And so that's not something that I think is going to be ever universally the case. Like Hong Kong is very dense and the system is very new. So the maintenance is going to be less than a very old system. It kind of gives you a sense that there's a lot of different avenues that we could be approaching the funding issue from. And I think when it comes to talking about taxpayers and like how do we know we're getting value for money, when it comes to something like a bus lane, I think we should be spending more effort talking about how like this is a tax reduction measure. By making the buses run faster, it makes TransLink's operation less expensive. And so I think that transit agencies could kind of beef up their fiscal talk and like talk about how cost effective they are and how efficient they are, because they are.
Rhys then expanded into examples of certain cities and operators that have gotten really efficient and effective at building transit, including highlighting examples of public-private partnerships, also known as PPP. I also asked Rhys whether there was any credibility to common complaints about inefficiency of government-funded projects and operations.
It's a really hard question, right? The reality is, if you just like look at the transit systems out there, most are not privately operated, but there is always a private element, right? The quote I like is like, the government never owns the shovels, right? Private companies build the projects. In a lot of places, like in Europe, a lot of private companies compete to operate the systems. Sometimes they compete with the public agency, and that does help like keep them competitive and thinking about like new technology and innovation. What's funny is that MTR, they're in Hong Kong and they're the Hong Kong system, but they run systems in places like Melbourne and they run the metro system in Stockholm. Transit agencies that get like really effective, they often do go to other cities to implement good public transit there as well. In terms of kind of like cost effectiveness, there is a real concern. Like when you look at how much transit projects have costed over time, even in Vancouver, they've gotten so much more expensive. And you can see that with the Canada Line, the Broadway subway so perfectly. And I think it's like the perfect example of it, because the Canada Line cost less than the Broadway subway. And yet the Canada Line is 19 kilometers. It has like 10 or 12 underground stations. The Broadway subway only has 5. It's remarkable how cost effective that project was. When you look at like the prices that they build transit for in Korea, for example, it's like my favorite example. a subway is typically 100 million per kilometer in Korea, and that's like a big subway. Like it's Seoul-sized. It's like a 8-car trains and everything, way bigger than what you see in SkyTrain. Broadway subway is something like 500 million per kilometer. It's 5 times more expensive. Like that's all PPP. So that's adjusted for wages and different currencies and stuff. They're so efficient at building in Korea. They're so much better than us, but you see very little coverage of that or very little talk of it, but it's why they're able to build such big systems. It's the same as Spain with their giant high-speed rail system that people talk about. They think, oh my God, they must be going into such crazy debt and everything. But the thing is, they're just really effective at building. So they actually don't have to spend very much money to build a lot. And my biggest fear is that cities like Vancouver, they'll look at cities like Toronto that are even worse, like less cost effective, and they'll move in that direction because they'll be like, well, Toronto must be better because it's bigger, right? When it was actually Vancouver in like 2010 was like actually really good at building transit. And it's like getting worse and worse because we're kind of doing more stuff where we handwork to consultants, which is always going to be more expensive than having like people at TransLink who can do things. Because if an employee is at TransLink, the employee gets paid, but there's no like, you know, overhead from the business that we know the business has to be paid. And so having more public agencies that are capable of not doing the whole project themselves, but being able to draw up design drawings and do the engineering work themselves is so important. We're often seeing that agencies are hiring more consultants so they can trim their operating budget, which is often what, you know, gets all the attention. Like, oh, this many tax dollars a year go to TransLink. But we're paying for that in way more expensive projects. And it's like, oh, wow, the Broadway subway is 5 times more expensive, probably 10 times more expensive than it would be if it was in Korea. So there's a huge cost there. But also the opportunity cost of like, if subways cost a fifth as much, we would have just built UBC and Langley and Surrey all in one go. And so basically the overlying thing that we need to solve is we need public agencies that have the capability to design and develop projects. And we need to focus on efficient projects, like low costs. And usually that means more government. Like it means taking stuff that we hand to the private sector, like design and, you know, consulting and planning work, and having TransLink be capable of doing that themselves, because that just makes them kind of more nimble and more capable. If they have to go to a consultant every time they need like something changed, that just adds up over the length of a project. So having a single agency that can do everything, that's why MTR does run the systems in other cities, because they're able to do it so well. They can kind of like drag and drop that into another city and say like, okay, we know how to run a system. We know how to build the system. That's what you want. You don't want it to be like parceled out.
Rhys then highlighted that even within Vancouver, there are different models of operating the various SkyTrain lines.
The kind of most interesting example of this is that the Canada line, it's pretty inexpensive to operate compared to like systems in America because there's no drivers, which is still very unique. Like not many systems in North America are like that. But the Canada line is like notably more expensive to operate than the Expo and Millennium lines, despite being much newer. And that's because it has a private operator and there's like an overhead. The Expo and Millennium lines are like some of the most efficient transit lines in the world in terms of how low the cost of operation is, because they're publicly owned and operated, and so there's just not a lot of overhead.
I think recently you wrote something about how you think that in North America, our media is kind of like bad on transit and bad on urbanism. And I feel like that kind of captures what we've been talking about, in the sense that like when new projects are proposed or talked about, immediately the feedback is like, how will this disrupt businesses? How is this going to cost us so much money that the government isn't going to handle efficiently and whatnot? And then even during and after, it's like constantly reporting of like all the negative aspects, and you never really get the wins. You never get, oh, since the Canada line has been built, like this many people have been, like you said, taking the transit to go to the airport instead of, you know, driving or whatnot. So why do you think that is, and how do we kind of like shift that?
Well, I think that, you know, traditional media in particular is like famously negative and sensationalist. My view that I take with my my YouTube channel is that I try to like project a positive image of the future, because yeah, like building more transit, it's obviously good. It's going to like help the climate. It's going to help society, inequality, like every major issue, it's going to be impacted in a positive way. I wish media in general took a kind of approach of like, the way you cover things has an impact on how people perceive them. And if it's so skewed in, in favor of like, oh, someone wants to like paint a sign about like SkyTrain bad and run around on the sidewalk. Like they're going to go give them coverage, even if that's one person, and like everyone else on Broadway is like, yes, finally, like I can get around and it will be more efficient. And so I think media has a real responsibility to try to like better society. And like, it's pretty obvious that more transit is better for society. And it's pretty obvious that the media does a bad job of pushing a kind of a pro-transit agenda. Not that media should have an agenda, but the framing is everything. And I think it doesn't help that a lot of the people you'll see in media, I see this in Toronto a lot, are just, they're drivers. They're like talking about like in between the show, they're like, oh, the traffic was so bad today when I drove into work. Right. And it's just, that's not representative of the populace. In Toronto or Vancouver, you know, it's like 20, 30% of people using transit every day. And in a lot of areas, it's more than that. But it doesn't feel like media is 20 or 30% dedicated to transit riders or to like making the transit system better.
You mentioned something earlier that reminded me, whenever you are like even the local radio stations constantly, it's like traffic report, like here's the highway where it's jammed, the tunnel's doing this. And it's always focused on what is the situation for drivers. And it's never like this bus broke down or like
which
buses aren't running on
like why not?
It could be. It totally could be. And I think that would benefit a lot of people, because one of the frustrations that Aaron and I talk about often is like the lack of reliable updates to TransLink on like Google Maps or anything else, right? And yet if you were a driver, there's so many resources for you to go to be like, okay, what route should I take today? Which one of it is clear?
Two things. One is doing something like including transit on the traffic report, as I said, obvious thing to do. And also, even if you're not using transit, it's just like a little thing that reminds you that like, hey, that's an option too. Just the way that every transit rider is reminded that driving is an option all of the time, constantly, you know, like we see cars. Oh yeah, I could drive. So I think that's so important. But also in terms of what people can do, I mean, just like call your local politician and like email them. If 10 people email like a city councilor, that's like a crisis. It's like a nuclear level crisis. People don't take action. And you know, if your bus is late, like be relentless, call TransLink, email TransLink, email your local politician. They will maybe not fix it, but they will know about it for sure. And it will be something that they'll think about, and it will shape the way that they go into their next meeting talking about transit or something of that sort.
I think we need to break the cycle of thinking about what we set as norms in terms of how we go about our day-to-day in our city, that taking transit is an option just as well as, you know, driving, like you mentioned. And the whole idea of like, if a bus is late or, you know, something's going on with public transportation, that we should demand better, that that's, you know, not okay. Because if something were to come up in our daily driving commute, you'd be sure people would be hearing about it. Like it'd be on the news, right? Of whatever collision happened. So I think that's a really good point. And I think people often just resign to like, oh, well, you know, the bus is late and like, that's just how it is.
And that's what like a group like Movement can help do, right? Is that it can help organize the frustration and kind of direct beam of public complaint at TransLink and at politicians and try to balance things out a bit more. Because like, as I said, a lot of people use transit. I don't know what the stat is in Vancouver, but in Toronto, 1/3 of people don't own a car, like in their household. And all those people, you know, they are constituents too. They deserve, a good public services. They deserve a responsive government. And so I think that it's really about demanding more and just reminding people constantly that like drivers and cars are not treated in the same way.
Recently, we had like a massive snow event. And of course, Vancouver being Vancouver, shut down the city. And the next day when they plowed the streets, you could see people I knew were taking pictures. It's like, you've got the car lanes that are completely free. And meanwhile, like all of it has been shoved onto like the bus stops where people are walking. And it's so clear that that's our priority of first thing we got to do is make sure the streets are clear for people to drive about. If you're walking, if you're taking the bus, your bus isn't coming for like 4 hours and nobody talks about how that's not okay.
Yeah. And it isn't.
Maybe in terms of like what we can look forward to with Movement starting up now, do you have any like information as to other advocacy groups, either in Toronto or other places in the world, where that's had a positive influence on the public transportation system?
The Toronto example is kind of uniquely good. So the group that we have is called TTC Riders. And like, I do not agree with everything that they advocate for, like all of the time, but I do agree that they're like a universally good thing. And what is so cool is that they are like relentless with the media. And so like anytime there was a story about public transit, like I would say 80 to 90% of the time, someone from TTC Riders will say more, you know, more bus service, you know, more reliability, like lower fares, like They're so relentless. And even if you're not on board with every single policy that they kind of endorse, they ride transit. There are a bunch of people who like use the system. And so it's like, it's just a force for good. And when there's a mayoral election, they like go ask all the candidates, what are your policies on all of these transit issues? And they make a lot of noise about like the politicians that don't commit to better transit service. And I think that movement will be very positive for Metro Vancouver, because it will be the same thing. It'll just be like, you know, a positive force that kind of accelerates things in the transit and human direction. Because with transit, cycling and walking, every journey starts as walking, right? And so it's just about like being able to safely walk to a stop, or being able to like have shelter at a stop and your bus coming on time. Like all of these basic things, they can push on and they can kind of pressure the governments on. And I think it's a super great thing. And I think it's going to be really good for Metro Vancouver. And people should definitely join it and, you know, support however they can.
It seems like you're putting a lot of excitement and focus onto the possibilities of what we can expect in not just North America, but just in general. And I think that that's something that we kind of just need, is to like bring that conversation up to the forefront, get people excited about like what cities could be in terms of improvements. So, yeah.
No, thank you for having
me on. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, no. And I think Vancouver's at the leading edge. So it's, people got it pretty good.
Rhys has shared with us a lot of interesting insight when it comes to public transportation. There's so much we can do to improve our infrastructure, but it really starts with the transit agencies themselves. And agencies should dream big, not just to be aspirational, but so that we can plan with decades of future in mind. This needs to be done collaboratively with other aspects of city planning to ensure that we are capitalizing on efficiencies of providing transit near jobs, homes, and everything in between. These efficiencies are proven when we look at international systems like the MTR in Hong Kong. There is a real skill in designing, building, and operating transit efficiently and cost-effectively. And there is no reason why we cannot build that capacity ourselves. So, as we hear the common public criticisms when it comes to publicly funded transportation, it is important to consider these in light of a bigger picture, which is an expanded, improved, and more reliable transit system that positively improves movement for everyone. There are many ways we can get involved with improving transit. For starters, we can talk about it. Vancouver's public transportation system does have a lot of perks that we often take for granted, and we should be celebrating these a lot more often. Shift the focus from temporary construction impacts to the long-term regional benefits. And if you are particularly passionate, you can always get involved with your local advocacy group, such as Movement, a new nonprofit run by transit riders in Metro Vancouver. They're pushing for better transit by making sure the voices of riders aren't overlooked. You've been listening to Urbanism Vancouver, the podcast dedicated to bettering our built environment. Be sure to follow us on your listening platform of choice so you don't miss our future releases. I'm Helen Loy. Thanks for listening. This podcast series was independently funded and produced by myself and Aaron Johnson. Visit us at urbanismvancouver.com.